on 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty. Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies, it's Wednesday the 30th of March and this is Game On. Coming up today, all those Cork lads on the pitch and it took a dub to win it. They're David Snaid's words, not mine. He's in studio to wrap up an eventful international window.
Haran delivers the cross, this could be it for Ireland. Ball breaks on the edge of the area and the driven shot. Oh, what a goal from Troy Parrott. Ireland have won a Troy Parrott, denied a few moments ago.
We'll also meet the concussion expert who's changed the way it has been researched and treated in sport. Plus, in GAA, we'll get the latest on the GPA-GAA standoff. And there's big calls to be made on suspensions and venues ahead of the championship. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. David Snaid is with me in studio. As I said at the start, David, after an eventful international window. Big highlight last night, though, being there and seeing Troy Parrott get that goal in the Aviva Stadium.
Yeah, I suppose there's one way to win a friendly against Lithuania. It's it's like that. Yeah, I think that tweet that I sent out, and then I used it in the piece for the 42 about the five Cork lads, and then it took a dub to win it. I think I got a bit of blowback on that on social media from some people, and I actually got an interesting message last night from someone in the FAI that the message had been read out to some of the players after the match, just as a bit of a joke. And my initial reaction, just, you know, as a wannabe comedian, was, oh, how did it go down, you know, and just got a message back saying, mixed reaction. So, I know, it was...
You're just loving it because you're a dub.
I know, yeah, and listen, as people who are listening to this will know that message was sent out firmly, tongue-in-cheek, and with just a small bit of happiness and a small bit of joy.
It wouldn't be like Cork people now to take offence.
Oh, no, not at all. And they'll take it very well. And it's like, I have my stag do down in Cork, so I've got a lot of graft for Cork. But, you know, it was actually, even with Parrott, because, like, I feel as if people have known about Troy Parrott for so long now. Like, he just seems to be one of those players who, since Robbie Keane has left, and the profile that he's had in terms of getting that move to Tottenham at a young age, that people are kind of willing him to be the next man to step up. And then you see a moment like that, and listen, his game of the weekend is against Shrewsbury Town for MK Dons on loan. So, like, that just shows you where he's at in terms of his development. He still has a long, long way to go. But it was just a great moment for him, really was. Like, obviously, he got those very important goals, if you remember as well, back in the summer against Andorra at a time when Andorra had taken the lead. And this is when Stephen Kenny's future as Ireland manager would have been. People would have been out for him if they had lost that game during the summer. Parrott stepped up and scored two really good goals. But after the game, I kind of just tossed straight back to, I remember doing an interview with Pat Jennings, the legendary kind of Tottenham Hotspur goalkeeper. And it's just funny how this came into my head afterwards, but he spoke about when Troy arrived at Tottenham just as a teenager, because all the clubs, main clubs in the UK, were chasing him from the age of about 14. Like, Everton had him playing a match for them, and he eventually went to Spurs, played a game actually in a tournament in Belgium, and Mauricio Pochettino's son was in the game, and he kind of just raved about him as well. But Pat Jennings was talking about how he would have little chats with Parrott around the training ground, and he always just struck him as a lad who wanted to do well and had a good aura about him, and always kind of was interested in what he had to say. And obviously Pat Jennings was an amazing goalkeeper, record appearance holder for Northern Ireland, and just, well, you think he might have been passed out there recently actually, but he was saying of just, he was giving little tips on little moments of how to open his body for certain strikes, or what a goalkeeper might not be expecting in certain moments. And it was just interesting because, like, Pat Jennings would have been a very close friend of late Luke Kelly. Luke Kelly's from Sheriff Street. Troy Parrott is from Buckingham Street, as he said himself last night when he was saying it's just a mile away from the Aviva over the other side of the Liffey. And he was kind of saying, you know, he didn't even think Troy would be old enough to listen to Luke's CDs, let alone the records. But even stuff like that, just a kind of a generational gap that people might not have even been aware of. But just when it's always stuck in my head that when you kind of see him, maybe, or you kind of wonder sometimes, are Pat Jennings' words ringing in his ears a little bit, you know? But just for Troy now, it's just a case, I would say, of, and he spoke about this because it was interesting, he was put up for media duties at the start of the week before the Belgium game, and he kind of spoke about how he has come to a realisation that to be a professional footballer, he has to work a lot harder than he had been doing over the last little while in terms of how he was not so much conduct himself off the pitch, but just how he was working on the pitch, training every single day, putting the graft in every single day, and wanting to be the best player every single day in training, and coming to that realisation, which is ideal for a 20-year-old, because like, the sooner you can cop on like that, the better. It's gonna bode well. Like, he obviously had that chance under Mourinho where he got a few minutes in the first team and he was given a big show of getting the match ball at the end of a game, but it was pretty clear that that was just maybe a little bit of a taste, because he still has so much more to go. And then you see a moment like that, the control, the touch, and just the awareness and the technique and the power of that strike, like, you can't not come away from a match like that and be a little bit excited about what could be to come.
So often we hear stories about, or from, footballers who come to a similar realisation, like you mentioned that Troy had, but it's at the latter end of their career and that they wish they had done it when they're earlier. So even for him to have that awareness now that in his early 20s he needs to start working harder is a really good sign of him. But I remember around the time when Harry Kane was injured and there was so many question marks about whether, or conversations about whether Troy was going to be stepping into that role, like that was the level he was being held at there for a while. It's crazy when you think back. And although professionally he's probably not where he wants to be, but from a personal development point of view, it might not be a bad thing to drop down a little bit and to have to work back up again and learn that you need to put that work back in again, or maybe in for the first time, because you're surrounded by the best people in the international stage, that he will have learned so much from that. But also the pressure's not on him anymore, because we're not having as many conversations about Troy Parrott. We're now starting to talk about the likes of Evan Ferguson. So even though it feels like in ways that big moment has passed for him, it hasn't yet, because he's still so young. And even though we're talking about 16-year-olds, he still has his whole career in front of him. And you would hope that whatever has gone on in the last couple of years, that he's going to be different and keep pushing forward now from starting last night.
Well, that's it. Like, he has another year left on his contract at Tottenham. But like, the experiences that he's already had, in the sense of, like, it's mad. He went on loan to Millwall. He was starting last season, and they had this big social media blitz about Troy Parrott coming from Tottenham, and that just kind of gives you an indication, a little bit of, like, you kind of get a sense, you can kind of get wrapped up in a little bit of a bubble here in terms of what's the next big thing for an Irish player, or for Ireland, and who's next. But that was where he was being seen, even with regards to English football, that, like, for Millwall to have got Troy Parrott was seen as this massive coup, and a Championship club who were bigging him up. But the move didn't work out for him. He had a couple of injuries, he wasn't able to get into the team properly, he wasn't able to just get that run of form, and it didn't work. The same thing really happened at Ipswich. He wasn't able to hit the ground running. So he has those couple of different experiences that do help shape that thinking. Now, a player can go one or two ways. They're kind of like, oh, this is a bit harder than I was expecting it to be. Oh, I don't know, like, what's going to, like, will he just drift? Whereas he's kind of realised, and as he said it, and you mentioned there about where he wants to be, like, he spoke about, you know what, he's actually exactly where he feels as if he should be, in terms of the experiences that he's already had on and off the pitch, what he's learning about the game. Because especially as a striker, he came on in that game and you just got a sense of it, like, straight away he was just getting involved. Stephen Kenny mentioned that afterwards when he had a conversation with him, that he wasn't going to be playing, because he obviously pulled him beforehand to explain, say, listen, I'm going to be going with Will Keane, wanted to see how he would operate with Ogbeni and Callum Robinson. And Troy Parrott wasn't happy. Now, that could be, you could maybe think a few years ago, if a young lad coming through might maybe have a bit of a strop and he might not be happy, and he could be sitting on the bench and be like sacking it off a little bit, thinking, you know, why does it, I play for Tottenham Hotspur, I deserve this. But where he's already at and what he's already been through, he was like, well, okay, take it on the chin, get on the pitch and prove yourself. And that's what he's basically doing. He's like still learning the game, learning the trade, and there can be all the hype about him, and when he produces moments like that, that'll stick in people's minds and people will have expectations about him. But when you hear him speak and you hear him talk about what he needs to do, like, one of the comments, and it really struck me, that I was thinking, do you know what, fair play to you, was he kind of said, like, kind of realised that it's not going to be as easy as it was coming through when you're 15, 16, 17, and he's the main fella. Like, he's scoring goals in the UEFA Youth League, scoring hat-tricks, and like, you can get a kind of false sense of where you're at when you're like standing out at that level. But it's how you deal with the different environment and the demands of when you're in a first team. And so far it seems as if, yeah, he's come through some struggles and it hasn't been just a total upward trajectory, but it feels as if he's someone who, over the course of a career, because it won't be just all the way up. You mentioned Harry Kane. Like, you look at some of, like, even this season when he was out with Farmer and hadn't scored, people are saying, oh, he's finished. And then you see him the last couple of months and he looks like the best player and the best striker again in the league. Like, so, but it just seems as if he's already capable and knows, and he's switched on to deal with how football is and not to let these amazing moments go to his head, and not when things aren't great for him, not to think that's where he's going to be stuck and that's where he's going to be stuck into, because you kind of, you get that sense that he's going to be able to forge that career for him. We don't know where it's going to take him. Hopefully it's scoring goals for Ireland and it's successful and he can reach as high a position, as high a level as he can in England. But so far it does seem as if he's setting that groundwork for himself.
Yeah, and look, from a personal point of view, I'd say scoring that goal last night in front of all those people, his family, like, that's amazing. And
Well, to borrow another Dublin phrase, was deadly.
It really was. What about the Ireland performance in general? We're kind of focused on the last minute because it was amazing, but up to that, it wasn't that amazing, was it?
No, that's it. And listen, I made a point as well in the article I wrote for the 42 about the game. Like, it was largely frustrating because obviously there was changes made. You kind of wonder if maybe Stephen Kenny had made just a couple of changes and kept the spine of a team who, if that was a qualifying game or if that was a Nations League game, for example, to see how they would have fared with breaking the team down. But because it was a friendly, they just played Belgium a couple of days beforehand, he had to mix things up, like, making the point about just the morale of his squad as well. Like, it's all great where we can talk about fans really buying into what's happening with Stephen Kenny's Ireland team now and the run of positive results, but when you're bringing lads over to play for or represent their country or be involved, and it's two friendly games and you're leaving lads out and they're going back to their clubs, and a lot of them are going through, would have big finishes to the season, not that it's worth their while that they're involved because they're representing their country, but you need to see how they get on. And he would have learnt in terms of some of this trouble of breaking them down, the lack of patience. Even, like, one of the points, Callum Robinson, like, he's really, really, really important for Ireland, and he seemed to get a bit frustrated even early in the game with taking pot shots just because of how Lithuania were set up. And that could be something as well that we worked on, just to have that little bit extra, little bit of patience. You kind of learn it, some players become better players when they're not there. That seemed to be the case with maybe Josh Cullen, people talking about, you know, you kind of get that, you get the idea now of how much Josh Cullen really does make Ireland tick when he's not there. And I think that was lacking from in that game. And listen, there's four goals disallowed for offside, and if you look at a couple of them, if Benny kind of holds his run a couple of minutes or a couple of strides longer, he's probably going to score that and be onside at the near post. Again, we mentioned Troy Parrott, if he maybe releases his pass for James McLean a little bit quicker, fraction a second quicker, he's going to be onside, and it could have been a totally different reflection on how the game was. But you could still see that there's times where Ireland just do still lack that bit of, as to borrow Johnny Giles's phrase, bit of guile and a bit of, like, in the midfield to kind of just open teams up. And you had to try and find other ways of doing it. It kind of looked as if you could tell with the three centre backs, like Nathan Collins was told, obviously you bomb on, and then I don't think maybe those times maybe where John Egan really seemed to be doing that early on under the reign with Stephen Kenny, but I think he was a bit more responsible. He had to kind of maybe hold the fort a little bit more. Obviously Matt Doherty really grew into it as the game went on, so it was frustrating for large parts. It really was. That's partly one of the reasons why some people would have been leaving the ground early not to see it. But I would be more worried if you're looking at that as if you're thinking, right, that's the strongest Ireland team that was put out there and they still struggled to that performance or struggled with that kind of performance or result. I think it was because of the nature of so many changes. I think you can kind of cut a bit of slack on the fact that if you really want to be positive about it, the subs who came on, like Jason Knight, helped inject a bit of positivity and a bit of energy into it. James McLean did so as well. Jeff Hendrick a little bit, and then obviously Troy Parrott too. But yeah, I go back to that. I would say if that had been maybe what you would consider Ireland's strongest 11, then it would have been a lot more concerning. I think the fact that there had been so many changes maybe disrupted the flow a little bit.
Also as well, because of the performance against Belgium, and as you said as well, you know, the results keep coming these days, and for so long they weren't there. Our expectations have changed a little bit as well, which is a positive thing, because now we want a certain type of performance from this team. And when you throw in as well, David, just, okay, I know some people left it before the goal, but the fact that it does feel like there is a big crowd now behind this team and that there's a connection with the team, and even that there's a connection with the players themselves. And I think you could see that when Troy scored the goal, the amount of players that ran over to congratulate him. And you feel like there are just, there's a real unity and togetherness there. And for a long time, it didn't really feel like that, that the, you know, the connection with the manager hasn't been there.
It was drifting a little bit.
Yeah, it was drifting. And we felt also maybe before Stephen Kenny that, you know, we were constantly being told we didn't have the players to go and play a certain way. So these are things that, OK, we mightn't have the perfect performance, but it's all building to, you would hope, something good.
Yeah, that's it. Like, and if you look at what's happened over the last number of years, I think about it, like, qualified obviously for the Euros in 2012, haven't qualified for World Cup since 2002. There was the Euros in 2016, and like 2016 felt as if that was a time, you look back, that was a time when it felt as if there was actually another young team emerging a little bit post that, in terms of Jeff Hendrick, Robbie Bray scored that brilliant goal. Like Martin O'Neill had actually done a good job, even in terms of like getting the best out of Wes Hoolahan, who for so long had been overlooked by the previous management. And yeah, there was times when that previous management still had success as well, you know, but it always felt as if we were just kind of in, kept at arm's length a little bit, and it was like, well, we're doing this in almost
and it felt
in
really
spite.
Short term all the time.
Yeah, exactly. But that's it, exactly. And like, if you look what international football is like obviously you have to get results, of course, but, and even though it's your country, if you can't feel that connection to it and get that sense of, because there's players coming from all over, like, it's a bit hard to maybe get that real kind of sense of what a club team is about. And I think you need that in international football. You need to have that sense of togetherness, and a lot of Ireland teams have had that. It's been like the hallmark of any Ireland squad. You look through it down the years, it's supposed to be the whole spirit and all the rest of it, but you're also going to have to get that other sense of fans properly buying into it and being excited a little bit about it. I do think that's there, and that's going to be really important as well, having this great run now. Was it 8 games, I think it is, without defeat and stuff? But it's important now as well with the Nations League, because the Nations League is really important, even just in terms of trying to get that like playoff spot and helping to even qualify for the major tournament, is just kicking on now and like using this as a factor. And like, it's one interesting thing I would find would be like the number of late goals. I think one of the stats was something like 10 goals of 20 odd under Stephen Kenny have come after the 85th minute or something like that. But like, I don't think that's a coincidence. That's not, I don't think, just from hoofing long balls in or like throwing Shane Duffy up for a long throw or a corner, even though obviously think back to even the first game against, I think was it Bulgaria, when Duffy did score from a corner late on. It also comes from how Ireland they're changing the game. They're having more possession of the ball, they're making the opposition team work that little bit harder, moving them and dragging them out of position. Now, there was times last night where they didn't do that good enough against Lithuania, and it was very easy for them to kind of just sit into this what's called, I suppose, a low block, where you basically have like almost five at times with six at the back, and you have to be, that's where you have to move the ball quick, you have to be sharp, you have to be really, really testing that defence. And like, even against Belgium, like, Ireland were able to do that, like, and it wasn't just by being, even though they were moving the ball quickly, it's not by being direct and aimlessly, it's direct with a purpose and trying to like drag lads out and get them tired. And that's what has to happen. And like, that's now you see it, even like the under-21s had an unbelievable result as well early that evening too. That's, you're kind of beginning now to get that sense of that it's a proper structured even play from say the 17s, 19s upwards, where this is how we're going to play a little bit. This is what's expected of an Irish player now. It's not as if you have to tear everything up and say, well, everything that has happened for Irish football has been wrong, because it's not. Like, that spirit, that determination, that work ethic, that should be the cornerstone of any team. But if you can mix that in with just that little bit of extra belief and the technical ability, which so many other countries have, and Irish players have had that as well, but for so long it's been drilled out of them almost, or not properly channeled, now you're hoping that all those elements together can be properly challenged. And when you see what the 21s did, giving themselves a great chance now of getting back in and getting a playoff spot in their qualifying group, like 2-0 win away from Sweden, when you look at who wasn't available for them, like Gavin Bazunu qualifies to play for the 21s, Troy Parry, Adam Eadie, who obviously is injured, there's Aaron Connolly, there's Jason Nye, there's Andrew Omobamadeli, do you know?
Yeah, and amazing.
All that, and yet this sort of group of players, who obviously Jim Crawford would have worked with Stephen Kenny with the 21s. Again, it's a benefit of Stephen Kenny having worked with the 21s as well, when he can bring these lads through. But other lads step up. Like, you look at Conor Coventry, who now a teammate on loan with Troy Parry at MK Dons, and obviously on the books at West Ham. And then there was a great, I don't know if you saw it, there was a great video put up around St. Patrick's Day by the FAI of of lads who maybe play for Ireland or qualify for Ireland, different like the men's, women's teams throughout the age groups of through the heritage drill, and you listen to Conor Coventry talking about what it means to represent Ireland, and you're like, get that lad into an Ireland jersey for the senior team. That, like, if he can develop, like similar to Josh Cullen, wherever he ends up, if he can develop and become that player, you just know this fella's going to give everything for the jersey, and that's what you want. And then if you can add that little bit of quality and belief, and the fans are buying into that, and the fans are excited about that, and the fans believe that these lads want to play football, well then, like, you've got, you're onto a recipe for success.
Yeah. Future looks bright, is what you're saying, David, yeah?
Yeah, also, yeah.
Before we move on, I just want to talk a little bit about the Women's Champions League quarterfinals. So Barcelona and Real Madrid are currently playing, 37 minutes gone, and it is 1-1, although Barcelona do hold an aggregate lead, 4-2 on that one. But it's more the attendance that I want to talk about, David, and I'm always loath to focus on the things like records and attendances about women around women's sport, because I like to think now that we're at a stage where we're actually analysing and focusing on what's happening on the pitch. But this, in fairness, is a big one, because they have sold over 99,000 tickets for this game, which is unbelievable. So the record crowd was the 99 World Cup final, and it was 90,000. So we haven't got official confirmation yet, but it looks like they're set to break that anyway. And I just think the whole Barcelona story is pretty phenomenal, because you would think they'd be a team that would just use their money to buy all the players that they possibly could and develop into one of those super clubs overnight, but they didn't. They focused on their academy and bringing players in and coaching them the way that they wanted to play, a bit like they're doing in the Ireland under-age setup.
And it's almost as if having a structure and having a plan actually works in football regardless.
And that's what they did. And they brought the players in, and they just coached them properly. They developed, they got their academy up and going, and they were able to bring players through. And then they added to them, obviously, as the years went by. But it wasn't, they weren't the overnight success that maybe some of the other bigger clubs, the other big clubs were. But they now are playing unbelievable football and going out and winning trebles as we saw last season, and getting record crowds. And I just think it's because they put the right structures in place and took the time to get to where they are now.
It's about, like obviously, I don't know what the culture is like. Obviously, Barcelona is a huge club, but like you speak so well, again, I'm just relating this small bit to the League of Ireland, but it's about creating that culture of going to matches and about giving a purpose to what's actually trying to happen. If they can see that there's proper development going behind something, and it's not just, as you were saying there, we'll throw a few bob at it and see if something sticks, it's actually from the ground up, well then that's going to lend to success. And just obviously before we came into the studio, I'm going to give Maria Leon the benefit of the doubt. It looked to be an absolutely tremendous goal, because I think she shaped to take a cross from kind of a bit of an in-swinger. I think she copped that, the Real Madrid keeper was anticipating that, and she just slightly changed direction in her body shape, and she just whipped it in over from about 30 yards out, just over her head. And I think Real Madrid equalised with a penalty, I think. But it does look like a very interesting game, and obviously tomorrow is going to be yours interest as well, with Kate McCabe for Arsenal too. So, but it's like what you say, like looking over the weekend, I think Man United had their first game with fans at Old Trafford for the women's team. They beat Everton. But if you're just looking at it from the point of view of even just the optics of seeing a match in not so much a proper stadium, but a stadium that you associate with Manchester United, like if you're seeing, you turn on, you see Barcelona playing in the new camp, that's where you associate Barcelona, and it just feeds into that sense of it is the one club. Look what happens with Shelbourne in the League of Ireland. Like, they are going for that one club philosophy whereby they're all in it together. It's not the women's team are over here and the men's team are over there. Like, it's the one club, and that's how it should be. Like,
it's fascinating because this is only their third time playing there. So they played in 1970 on Christmas Day, a women's Barcelona team. Now, they weren't the men's associates back then. It was just a representation from Barcelona. And they had 60,000 people there in 1970. So there was even the potential back then. And it's actually quite frustrating when you think that what could have been. But then obviously there was a huge amount of setbacks for women's sport. And they played again there in January 2021, in the 50th anniversary of that fixture. And it was behind closed doors. And now they're back in again. But when you see that and you think that, you know, there's years and years lost out in what could have been promoted and developed, it would drive you crazy. But at least they're back now, and there is only one way they can go from here, and that is up and forward. And it looks like women's football is going to keep pushing on, but things like that need to keep happening, and they need to get the same opportunities, as you said, where they are playing in the big stadiums and there are one club models and they're getting the same support and they're wearing the same jerseys.
Yeah.
And when you're handing out your male sticker, you get the women's sticker with it and all that sort of stuff. And I just think the future looks so different now for women's sport.
It's just creating that sense that it's not them and us kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It just seems so obvious that,
yeah.
But even like the point you were saying about, say, the game that was back in the 70s, but like, if you were putting on an occasion in a stadium like that, and that feels as if, well, that's where they play, it's only natural that surely that's going to lead to increased revenue, it's going to lead to increased exposure, it's going to lead, also think about it, it's going to lead to players getting better because they're playing on better pitches, but they're playing in environments where they're going to be tested in different ways and bring more out of them. But also from a fan's point of view, like, I had friends who I know went to the Man United the game at the weekend, and part of the reason why they were happy to go was, and I know it sounds bad, but it's because it's at Old Trafford. Like, the women's team who play for Man United normally play, like, it's like out of town, outside Manchester. There's no actual train station that goes to the town that you even play. I think it's called Lee Sports Village where they play. It can just be almost difficult to even get there. There's almost a roadblock there before you even want to even go to a game, you know. Whereas you shouldn't be putting these hindrances in place if, as you were saying, and it's clear that it's just so obvious that there's so much more potential still to come. And even just looking at that goal, I think even the second half is set up really nicely because it's going to be 1-1 going into the second half.
The Barcelona women's team usually play out in the Barcelona training ground, and I think they only average about a few thousand, but if they started regularly playing in the Nou Camp, you would think that it would grow and grow and grow. But
it's incremental.
Yeah, like, even in being in the academy, like, they're being coached like a men's team, like, you know, possession plays football, they have a 4-3-3 system that everybody seems to know now, and they're just...
But that's the only reason why maybe what has held the women's game back is because it hasn't been treated in terms of the same resources put into it. Like, if you're given, no matter who you are, what age you are, what sex you are, if you're given a level of coaching from an early age, it's going to develop you. It's not as if absolutely. You're going to be like a 6 years old and you can't play football because you're a woman, or you can't play football because of X, Y, and Z. It just makes no sense. Whereas if you're actually coached and the resources are in, like, we've already been here, obviously, we say chatting, and even when Nadine will be in here talking about, even with, say, ladies Gaelic football and Camogie, and you see some of the obstacles that are there in terms of being able to get training pitches.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're constantly fighting just to do the basics, well, then how are you supposed to improve? But if everything's in place for you, that's in place for other people, well, then it's only natural that you're going to be able to develop, and that's how the game should be.
Absolutely. Okay, on that note, we're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us as we'll be chatting concussion very, very shortly.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. I'm delighted to say that we are joined now on the line by Dr. Mickey Collins, an internationally renowned expert on sports-related concussion. Mickey is also a director and a founding member of the UPMC Sports Medicine Concussion Programme, which was established in 2000. It is the first and largest research and clinical programme focused on the diagnosis, evaluation and management of sports-related mild traumatic brain injury in athletes of all levels. Now, Mickey, I'm delighted that you have joined us on the line. First of all, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
I run the concussion program the UPMC Sports Medicine Concussion Program. Former athlete, washed up now, but used to play sports, was very interested in the sports and the brain, and somehow combined those two things, and now that's all I do, is see patients who have concussions. And we've done a tremendous amount of research in understanding this injury, and we do a lot of clinical work. And I really feel this is an injury that's manageable and treatable. It just needs to be done the proper way. And there's a lot of new information and a lot of advances we've made in terms of understanding concussion.
We're definitely talking about it a huge amount more. There's a lot more education. There's a lot more people feeling more comfortable talking about it. But there's still an awful lot of fear around the word concussion. Why do you think that is?
There is a lot of fear around it, and we actually did a Harris poll here in Pittsburgh and found out that 86% of parents think you need to lose consciousness to have a concussion, when in fact you don't. There's about 75% of parents feel that concussion results in permanent brain problems, which it doesn't. You know, so there's a lot of misinformation out there about this injury. I think a lot of it surrounds the discussion in the media about potential long-term effects of concussion. And the reality is that we've really learned a lot about this injury, how it presents. We've learned there's different types of concussions, and that if you treat the injury properly, we can mitigate potential long-term effects of the injury. You know, the best form of preventing problems with concussion is to treat it properly when you have one, and fortunately, a lot of advances have been made in that regard.
From your point of view, what is the most significant advance that's been made?
The fact that we now have treatments, and the fact that we've now identified that there's different types of concussions. So if there's 30 different types of knee injuries, why do we think there's one type of concussion? The brain is infinitely more complex. And we've now learned, you know, concussions is energy crisis to the cells and neurons in the brain. And certain systems in the brain can decompensate from that energy problem. And we've now learned that there's 6 different types of problems that we see following concussion. And if you match the right treatment to the right problem, we can then have outcomes that allow kids to get back to play safely. But it does need to be managed carefully, and it doesn't need to be managed by a specialist who understands how to treat this injury. And that's where UPMC is coming in. We have a program called the UPMC Concussion Network, where we've now trained clinicians in Ireland with the advances we've made with treating this injury. And you have some of the most knowledgeable clinicians in your country now as it relates to concussion. And fortunately, we're getting patients to those clinicians in Ireland now, and those treatments are being delivered and the outcomes are being improved upon. I think Ireland is in a really good spot for really good concussion care now, and it's exciting to see that.
Michael, how are you? I'd be interested to see how that tallies in terms of when you're talking about the advances and the understanding that have been made in terms of different types of concussion and how it's properly treated. But let's say in a professional sports environment where a manager might want the player back on the pitch as soon as possible, or there could be different external pressures there for a player who maybe might have number of concussions or might have had issues. Like, there's still that issue too to deal with in the sense of maybe a person who might not be relying on sport for their living and how they might treat a concussion with how a player in a professional environment is brought back and properly treated with concussion.
No, I feel that, like, I know some of the team physicians in Ireland, and I think they do an excellent job with this. The reality is when in doubt, sit them out. I mean, if there's an injury where there's any signs or symptoms of concussion, that athlete needs to be taken out of play, and they shouldn't go back to play until the proper evaluation is conducted. We know that if you properly manage this injury, the outcome should be excellent. And the most important thing is to come out of play when there's signs and symptoms of injury. Now, can some athletes play through this injury and not tell someone they're having problems? Yes. That's to the athlete's detriment. We just did a study. We just published this in JAMA Pediatrics, where we looked at a large group of patients that had symptoms of concussion. I believe 125 patients had symptoms of concussion in the field and were taken out of play immediately. And then 125 patients that had symptoms of concussion and continued to play 15 minutes beyond the point of having symptoms of concussion. The patients that were immediately taken out of play recovered on average in 18 days. The patients that played for 15 minutes or longer took 44 days to recover from their injury. So just playing 15 more minutes beyond the point of having symptoms added nearly a month of recovery, you know, when they're going to miss more games because of that. It's very important that athletes understand the signs and symptoms of this injury and to report those signs and symptoms of injury, and to understand that if you remove them from play, the outcomes are going to be far, far better. And, you know, clinicians know that. I think there's very well-trained clinicians that are understand now what the signs and symptoms are, how to evaluate this properly on the field. And any of these professional issues shouldn't come into play. If there's signs and symptoms of concussion, they should not return to play. And I know that sounds simple-minded, and, you know, we work with the NFL, and, you know, there's a lot at stake in these situations. But I got to tell you, it's manageable if it's done properly, and that's very important, especially knowing the literature and research on the difference in outcomes that we see if it's not managed properly.
Mickey, I'm watching the Barcelona-Real Madrid match here in the background as well, and we were just talking before we chatted to you about how women's sport has developed so much and we're seeing so many more women have the opportunity to play professional sport. So I'd imagine that you've probably got more research in the last number of years on women and concussion. Are women more at risk than men?
Yes. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but we not only find that women have concussions more easily, but their outcomes take longer. And that's very well established literature and data, a lot of which comes from our program and many other programs that have you know, also verified that. Now, there's a lot of theoretical reasons why women may have a harder time. You know, not only do they get concussions more easily, but have longer outcomes. And probably the main reason is because women are 4 to 6 times more likely to have migraine, and migraine predicts longer outcomes from concussion. People that have any pre-existing migraines, it takes less force to cause concussion, and the outcomes are going to be longer, and women are 4 to 6 times more likely to have migraine than men. Neck strength may also play a role. There's certain hormonal influences that play a role, but it's still a treatable, manageable condition in women. But I agree with you. It's something that needs to be taken seriously, and women's sports are growing exponentially. And, you know, we have about 20,000 patients come through our program every year here in Pittsburgh, and about 60% of the patients coming through here are women, which is equivalent. That is very consistent with what we see in the literature. This injury happens more commonly in women than men. Doesn't mean it doesn't happen in men, because it does, but there's risk factors in women.
Just to touch on a couple of things you said there, and I'd be curious. So when you were saying there about what some parents think, what 86% of parents think, you mentioned, think that you have to be knocked unconscious to have suffered a concussion. And then when you were saying there that about if you don't play on after suffering one, is it 18 days you can recover in? And if you do play on for even 15 minutes, it could be 44 days. Should there Correct. Be, like, it's hard to even see when a concussion could happen, because it's not just two lads going up, say, in soccer and it's a header and they clash heads. It could be something that looks a bit minor that could actually cause it. How would you how would you kind of say, well, do you know what, this needs to happen straight away if there's a suspected concussion in a game?
I didn't mean to make it sound easy, because it's not.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this. So there's signs and symptoms of injury. Signs mean there are observable changes in an athlete's behavior. Losing consciousness obviously means you've had a concussion, and those players, everyone sees it. They should be taken out of play. And it's easy. If you lose consciousness, you should not go back to play following concussion. If you stumble, if there's sort of posturing on the field, motor posturing, if there's vomiting, these are all signs of injury, meaning there are observable changes, confusion, disorientation, amnesia or memory loss, vomiting, loss of consciousness, posturing, seizures. All those things are very observable. Maybe not very observable, but they are observable. Those are immediate no-goes. Anyone that has those signs or symptoms of injury after trauma should be taken out of play. There's no debating that. The problem exists with symptoms of injury, and what I mean by that is this is what patients are experiencing and report, but you may not observe. For example, dizziness. A lot of listeners may not be aware that dizziness is 6 times more predictive of poor outcome from concussion than is losing consciousness. If you have dizziness, you're 6 times, that's the most significant symptom that predicts poor outcome. And that is only reported by the patient. You can't see dizziness, if that makes sense. Fogginess or feeling one step behind, detached, disassociated is also another symptom that predicts poor outcome. But you also, you know, headache, light sensitivity, noise sensitivity, nausea, all those are symptoms of injury. And we actually found symptoms of injury predict worse outcomes than signs of injury, probably because the patients have symptoms of injury played through the injury. And that's why they have worsened outcome, if that makes sense to you, because we know that playing through is not the right idea. Mm. So these symptoms of injury, you know, if this is not reported to a clinician, I don't fault the clinician. There's nothing they can do. You can't observe that. If there's signs of injury, the athlete should not go back to play. And I think there's general consensus on that, and that should be happening with every clinician, that if those signs are shown, they shouldn't go back to play. It's the symptoms where it does get difficult. And that's where I really think it's upon the athlete to be educated on this and to be aware that they're not doing themselves any favors by playing through this stuff.
Yeah, you would hope that they are a little bit more educated than they have been in the past, because there is so much information out there. We get an awful lot of information as well as journalists, because we get medical updates and bulletins from the different professional teams. So we're quite aware of how many concussions certain players would have in different sports. At what stage does repeated concussion become a problem?
If it's not managed effectively, if you treat the injury properly, we should be able to hit the reset button on the great, great, great majority of athletes that we see. In patients that have an injury, it's not treated properly, they continue to play, get hit again, have an injury, it's not treated properly, get hit again, have an injury, you know, et cetera. Those are the patients that we have a harder time treating. And those are the patients that, you know, I mean, obviously it's not good for the patient to continue to do that. The biggest advances we've made with this injury, though, is the fact that we now do realize there's treatments. And we've identified six different concussions, and I can name those: cognitive or thinking changes, problems to the vestibular system, which is a part of our brain that allows us to stabilize our vision. We move our head, allows us to interpret motion, movement. The third type of concussion is ocular, so meaning your ocular motor system, your eyes have to work together as a team. We see a lot of impairments there. The fourth concussion is migraine, fifth is neck, and the sixth subtype is mood and anxiety, depression, et cetera. Now, some patients may have one of those types of concussions, and some patients may have all six, but there's different treatments for those six different types of problems. And it may surprise you to hear this, but rest does not treat the great majority of concussions. The way we treat these problems is actually by retraining the brain. So, for example, with a vestibular problem, that system, when it's not working properly, you'll feel foggy, dizzy, nauseous, like car sickness feeling. The way we treat that dysfunction is by retraining the brain. So actually, you know, creating movements, we have physical therapy that can retrain that system. The ocular system with the eyes, that decompensates. You'll have difficulties with focus and frontal headaches and feel tired. We treat that by retraining the ocular system. We have physical therapy to retrain that. So The point I'm making is that if I asked you two before stating this, how do you think we treat concussion, you probably would have told me rest, and that's actually not how we treat it. We treat it through rehab and rehabilitation and active and targeted approaches at treating the injury. And those advances have really occurred in the last 5 or 10 years. And I know the clinicians in Ireland that are part of the UPMC Concussion Network, they are up to speed on these treatments. We know how to rehab this injury. And we can actually get patients back to play more quickly and safely by doing these rehab treatments. And we share the same goals as the athlete. We want them back to play. We don't want them sitting out if it's not necessary. And we really now know how to identify who's recovered, who's not, and when it's safe to return to play. There's just been so many advances with the injury.
I actually did the UPMC baseline testing before. If it was a test, I think I would have failed it. But lucky enough, it isn't a test, and it's just information
I can tell you, I help to develop the test, and I fail it every time as well. So I hear you loud and clear.
How important is it for athletes to have this baseline testing done?
Very. We don't have any biomarkers to measure this injury. So there's no MRI, there's no CT scan, there's no PET image, there's no, you know, blood test at this point in time that in a sensitive and specific way can identify a concussion. And so what we're left with is a good clinical evaluation and tools that have been developed to measure the injury. And one of those tools that's very effective is what's called neurocognitive testing. So we developed a tool on a computer called IMPACT, which stands for Immediate Post-Concussion Assessment and Cognitive Testing. It's about a 20 to 25 minute battery of tests on a computer, and it measures things like visual motor processing, verbal memory, visual memory, reaction time. And in a perfect world, everyone would have a baseline. So we know where the person's cognition is before they get hit in the head. And then when there's an injury, or if it's diagnosed or questionably diagnosed, we can repeat that test, and we've created what's called confidence intervals. Standard errors and measurement have been incorporated. We know what normal changes on the instrument and what isn't, and that tool can really help to identify and quantify the injury. and it's highly valuable. Here in the United States, that testing is utilized throughout professional sports. It's utilized in almost every college. Here in Pittsburgh, every high school in this entire region has baseline testing completed, you know, before they play football or basketball or wrestling and, you know, the American sports that we see over here. We're now rolling that out in Ireland, and that testing is available through the UPMC Concussion Network. And I know we've worked extensively with the GAA, and they're rolling out baseline testing. I know rugby's interested in that. So that technology is available for your Irish citizens, and I really highly recommend it. It's incredibly valuable for patients that are playing at-risk sports to have a baseline before they play that sport. It goes a long way in helping us understand proper diagnosis, and there's even different neurocognitive correlates with the different types of concussions, so we can actually look at that data, and it helps to determine, you know, to us as clinicians, what type of concussion the patient has and how to get them treated properly, and most importantly, how to get them back to play safely. That data goes a long way in helping us with that. We can still evaluate concussion without it, but not as effectively with it, and that data is very valuable.
Okay, well, that's really good advice there. Thank you so much for joining us, Mickey. Lovely to chat to you. And if you're ever over in Ireland, do please drop into us.
I absolutely will, and I love your country. my name's Michael Collins, by the way, so I do well over there. Really brilliant. Nice meeting you guys, and thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
RTE
2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. David Snaid of The 42 is still with me in studio. David, you're glued to the football. Real Madrid and Barcelona in the Women's Champions League quarterfinal.
And I felt bad there. I was listening to Michael talk about a really serious topic, and then I was turned around. And just as I was turned around, it looked as if Real Madrid were going to really make this a game of it, because Zernoso Sanchez scored an absolute beauty of a goal where she got the ball about 35-40 yards on the half turn, saw the keeper off the line, and then just dinked it over from 35. Really good goal. That set up was like, well, I think then it was 4-3. It was looking like it was going to be a really good game and really strong finish. And then Barcelona, 2 minutes later, not barely even that, just sliced through them, really sharp pass into Bonmati Conca, and she took one touch, brought it inside, and then finished it through the defender's legs. And it looks now that should be what we're on 54 minutes. There could be more goals in this 5-3 in aggregate. And I'm raging. I'm going to be getting into the car and going home. Hopefully this is on the radio and listening to it, because it's set up really well.
Well, I'm going to talk Gaelic games with Colm Keyes now, and you're welcome to sit there and watch that for the next few minutes. Colm, how are you?
How are you?
Not so bad. We're watching women's football here, but we're going to talk about GAA now for the next few minutes, because there is a lot happening, as there always is, Colm. Let's start with Armagh and Donegal, and the fact that it looks like there is going to be a few suspensions from that melee at the weekend.
Yeah, notification to counties has gone out on foot of the referee Paddy Nealon's report. He obviously stood by and watched the melee unfold. And in light of Tyrone Armagh in the second round of the league, Marie, when David Goff sent off five players, Paddy Nealon didn't issue cards, but he mentioned certain incidents in his report. And on the back of that, up to five players, three from Armagh and two from Donegal, have been disciplined, and are proposed discipline charges placed against them. They, of course, can have a hearing, but contributing to a melee, potential one-match ban if they cannot have them overturned, and consequently will miss the Armagh-Donegal first-round match in just over 3 weeks' time. So the same two teams are playing in just over three weeks' time, and I'm sure there was a few calling cards being left at the end of that game last weekend in Letterkenny.
Yeah, well, just given how other scenarios have played out when people have been suspended so close to championship, you'd imagine there'll be a few CCCC meetings over the next week or so.
There'll certainly be hearings. Every one of them, of course, will seek hearings now on the back of this, and I'm sure after that there'll be the pursuit of appeals and possibly even further. This is probably still untested waters, really, for contributing to a melee. There has been other melees during the league that haven't been treated the same way, but it's really what the referee sees and determines. And in this case, I don't think the CCC themselves have had to resort to video evidence to to add any suspension. So it appears to be on the back of what's in the referee's report here. So it will be difficult for the counties to overturn that.
Okay. Well, what about what's going on with the Cork and Kerry column and their Munster semi-final? Where do you think it's going to be played? I know there's a meeting ongoing at the moment.
There's a meeting of the Munster CCC. A lot of CCCs very busy these days, but there's a meeting of the Munster CCC this evening to consider Parkyrin. There are concerns that the remedial works at Parkyrin will not bring it up to the capacity that Munster would have wished for a fixture of this size. This is their prime football fixture on Saturday, 7th of May, Cork and Kerry. And notwithstanding that Cork aren't going all that well, they still would have expected, you know, a crowd of double figures anyway, even anything up to 14,000, 15,000, anything up to 18,000. And they were hoping to accommodate 16,000. And Cork still think that the remedial works can be carried out in good time that will bring the venue up to that standard. Munster have their doubts. Currently it's at 9. They think it might get up to 10 or 11 and that wouldn't be sufficient. Cork issued a statement this morning to say we think it can get up to what was originally envisaged. The Cork management have come out with a very strong statement yesterday when they say there's double standards being applied here by Munster, because Walsh Park in Waterford will be accommodating the Cork hurlers against Waterford, and Cork hurlers would always bring a bigger crowd than the Cork footballers. Now, albeit Cork Kerry is, you know, would draw a big crowd in its own right, but Walsh Park would take far, far less. They wouldn't, just about 10,000 at that venue. So Cork management have said there's double standards at play here and that the game should go ahead as fixed. And of course, you had the scenario with Newbridge, mm-hmm. with the Mayo Kildare qualifier in 2018, and even Cavan Antrim earlier this year with Ulster had planned to take that out, but again, the venue was left because it's a home draw for Antrim. It was left with that rather than risk a fractious controversy over the next few weeks, and we'll see how it plays out for Cork.